From the Sky News Centre at 6, a man's been found guilty of murdering 15-year-old Paige Chivers in Blackpool in 2007. The 60-year-old's co-defendant in Preston Crown Court was also convicted of helping to dispose of her body, which has never been found. Police want the pair to reveal where Paige is. British tourists returning from Tunisia say they didn't feel unsafe after being told to leave the country because of terror concerns. The foreign secretaries defended the decision to update travel advice after being criticised by Tunisian officials who say it plays into the hands of terrorists. Special flights are bringing people home. These tourists flew back to Manchester this afternoon.
It's just very, very disappointing, and I should go back whenever we can.
There was armed guards when you went down to the beach. Every so often you'd see them walking past the pool, but wasn't a problem.
We never felt threatened at all. We had guards all around us.
You wouldn't have known anything was going on.
Police Scotland's chief constable has apologised for his force's failure to investigate reports of a car crash which left a couple lying in the wreckage for 3 days. A man died in the accident near Stirling. His girlfriend remains in hospital. Police think a teenage girl missing for 2 weeks could have gone to Spain with a 37-year-old man, Camilla Lupu, who's 14, was last seen in Oldham towards the end of June. Actor Omar Sharif, best known for films Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia, has died of a heart attack. He was 83. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
On BCFM, on BCFM, on BCFM, on BCFM, on BCFM.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message. I love you. Now, back to our show.
Love Bristol. Love. BCFM 93.2.
Britain is, in essence, a monarchy, not a democracy. Much of Britain still operates on a system of unelected power.
And at its centre are the Windsors, the old aristocracy, and their vast wealth.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Last week we looked at some of the holes in the official 7-7 story. This week, are we moving towards a police state and did the terrorists win? We've been told to take a week's break at the Politics Show because of some sticky bun affair called the Harbour Festival next Friday, so we take a longer view tonight of the rise of the police state here in Britain. Blogger and broadcaster with 21st Century Wire, Basil Valentine, joins us to take a look at the shutdown of investigative journalism and slow erosion of our civil liberties since the 2005 London bombings, but obviously over a longer period too. Following on from that, investigative journalist, privacy campaigner and author of two absolutely must-have books, one for your car glove box and the other for your bookshelf, Who Owns Britain and Who Owns the World? Kevin Carhill's here to bring us the latest on his legal action against the Internet Titans. There's news over the last couple of weeks too of child sexual abuse cover-up at Prince Charles, Prince Edward and Prince Andrew's school, Gordonston, in the Scottish Highlands. All the interviews with former pupils have disappeared, say the police, and they can't question the master doing the abusing either because he's gone and died in a car crash. Plus Martin Summer's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first of all, I'm joined on the line by Basil Valentine. Hi, Basil. Welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, can you hear me, Basil?
I can hear you, Tony. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay. Can you, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, about your background, Basil, and where we can find you online?
I'm a Cambridge sociologist, really. Ultimately, recently rediscovered my interest in all things political, which has been prompted by my observations of the way things have been going in this country over the last 20 years, which is very much not for the better, sadly.
Okay, I suppose the main premise of what we're discussing tonight is the 2005 London bombings and the various changes that there have been since. I mean, we've had various things. I mean, obviously an increase in surveillance and secret courts. But what to you are the most important changes that you've seen over the last few years?
Well, there have been various changes to legislation. You know, the creeping police states, really sort of death by a thousand cuts. We've got death by a thousand cuts to the welfare state. We've also got death by a thousand cuts to our civil liberties. A lot of people are not aware of things like the Inquiries Act, which was passed by the last Labour government, which severely limits the scope of public inquiries.
Now, that's really worrying, because we're looking right now at this inquiry into child sexual abuse, aren't we?
Which still doesn't have the status of a full public inquiry. It's been set up under different parameters. Only under pressure did Theresa May agree that it would have the power to legally subpoena witnesses. But, I mean, it's 12 months since it was supposed to be started, and the latest chairperson has only just arrived in the country from New Zealand. So it's all a bit of a farce, and it seems like things are being kicked into the long grass. But the biggest scandal of all, you mentioned 7/7, is that we didn't have a public inquiry into 7/7, instead just the publication of an, quote, official narrative. Which itself has changed on several occasions, you know, most recently about 4 years ago, when it was finally admitted that the bombs apparently carried by the four lads from Leeds were made out of pepper and hydrogen peroxide in somebody's bath. So the official version of events is that three separate holes in the floor of a tube carriage, which was lifted off the tracks at Edgware Road, were made by a bomb carried in a knapsack.
Okay.
Which obviously defies the laws of physics. So obviously a public inquiry would point that up. And, you know, people would be forced to think, well, hang on a minute, if that didn't cause the explosions, then what did? And obviously be forced to look for different answers.
Well, you've had the privilege of a Cambridge education and also a sociology. Tell us what that's given you as a sort of perspective, because one of the things that we don't get with our London media is the ability to take a step back and see how these patterns of events fit together.
Well, as I say, there have been, you know, various bits of legislation over the last few years. The Civil Contingencies Act is another one, which gives the police and the authorities sweeping powers in the event of a national emergency, which is very loosely defined. We've had numerous changes to legislation on terrorism. And, of course, recently the blurring of lines, very deliberate blurring of lines between, in inverted commas, terrorism and the vernacular increasingly used, particularly by David Cameron, of, quote, extremism. Now, as far as I know, in a liberal democracy, you're allowed to adopt what would be called extremist political positions. You could say that, you know, the Socialist Workers' Party or the National Front were both extremist parties, but they quite happily cohabited in the 1970s and even used to share platforms for lively debate. But now we're moving to somewhere where dissent itself is starting to be criminalised, certainly questioned, you know. But when it comes to the wider police state, I mean, the number of sort of contraventions of what we would expect in a liberal democracy are almost too numerous to mention. We had all that scandal over police officers impersonating activists and joining various sort of green and environmental campaigning groups, and in one case even fathering a child with a member of such a group while posing as an activist. He was in fact an undercover police officer all the time, and it's almost too bizarre to contemplate, you know. We've also had under the last Labour government a massive over-criminalisation with the creation of lots of new criminal offences, you know, all sorts of things that you used to be able to do in Britain you can't do. I mean, traditionally British common law is based on the fact that you can do whatever you like so long as it doesn't contravene the law, but the number of new offences means we're now really moving to something where you can only do what you're allowed to do. It's a subtle but important distinction. Plus, of course, you know, the advent of technological policing, face recognition software, as you said, surveillance, online surveillance, telephone surveillance. I mean, I've seen only today that if Cameron has his way, then the use of WhatsApp and various other messaging services will be outlawed, they'll be prohibited, because they require encryption. And he's actually said, we don't want, or do we want, to be able to not to be able to intercept any form of online or other communication. In other words, saying basically, you know, we want the ability to interrupt any conversation you may be having with anybody over any medium at any time. So that's total surveillance, obviously.
What about the Human Rights Act? Because many people are pointing to this as actually one of the main things which may be used to prosecute abusers, never mind the other forms of criminal legislation. And also there's another big... We've just had the anniversary, haven't we, of Magna Carta. Now, that's supposed to guarantee us basic rights. That is to say, for example, you have to be told what charges are against you. You can't be interred without trial, all this kind of thing. And those seem to be being eroded too. So what's happening there, Basil?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. That is those are some of the most important aspects of the creeping police state. I think the legislation is now in place for people to be detained. You know, Tony Blair was all in favour on terrorist charges for up to 30 days, is it? And held without charge. So the writ of habeas corpus, which is that, if you hold somebody, then you have to produce evidence against them and charge them in a court of law, and ultimately they're then tried by their peers on the basis of the evidence available. We're increasingly looking to move towards more of a sort of pre-crime situation, rather like the film Minority Report, where individuals, as a result of their behaviour or their choices or their attitudes, can be identified as potential criminals, as undesirable to one sort or another, and their liberties restricted. And the upcoming legislation, which Theresa May and David Cameron have signalled is coming in, will do just that. Cameron himself made a speech back at the UN in September, if people remember, in which he conflated Islamic extremism with 9/11 and the 7/7 truth, indicating that they were part of the same whole ideology, which is a very dangerous precedent, because, of course, that it means people like yourself, Tony, who simply want to discuss these questions openly and look for the truth and who question the official version of events, can be labelled as extremist and therefore subject to the same control orders as a terrorist.
Martin, by saying things like Western governments may have been involved in the 7/7 attacks and the 9/11 attacks, could we, you and I and others and anyone else that thinks such things and expresses them, be accused of aiding and abetting some kind of terrorist campaign?
Well, it's possible. It's always possible. I say bring it on, because the evidence that the intelligence services in the West are terrorists is frankly overwhelming, and any legal attempt to silence us will simply open Pandora's box.
In what way?
Well, because if they take us to court, we'll bring forward all the evidence we've been collecting that the Western intelligence services are major players in international terrorism.
Well, I'm not sure if Basil's going to do this before me, because they'll probably say it's a secret court.
Well, yeah. If it's a secret court, it's a secret court. But we went through all of this stuff in the Irish troubles over 30, 40 years. There's no doubt in my mind that Western intelligence services, working with their Arab allies in the Gulf, are behind major terrorist activities inside Syria. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record as saying that he was approached by British officials before the Arab Spring, saying, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria." Now, that means that named, we don't know their names, British officials, presumably military and intelligence officers, are in fact organising terrorists to go into Syria, and then of course some of them are coming back and carrying out terrorist attacks elsewhere, which they are also implicated. Now, if people say that's crazy stuff, well, I just say that's the facts. That's the facts.
Basil, what are your thoughts about... Well, Martin's being a bit provocative there, I think, saying bring it on, but what are your thoughts about the prospect of this kind of legislation making it apparently impossible to make these kinds of suggestions that the government, intelligence services, etc., people paid by our taxpayers' money may have been involved in these attacks?
Or even questioning the official narrative in any way, Well, it'll be the tipping point. We really will have entered a brave new world at that point, once published authors and other people who are vocal on these subjects start being silenced, detained or anything. We will have really crossed a Rubicon at that point, because at the moment, although given no publicity by the mainstream media, of course, and that's another question, there are nevertheless a lot of vocal activists who are prepared to speak out, who publish online and offline and so on and so forth. And at the moment, with impunity, it might all very well be on some big database at GCHQ, but in terms of day-to-day life still able to operate. So once that stops being the case, then the evidence for a police state will be that much more obvious, and all sorts of liberals and libertarians, for that matter, who've previously sort of looked the other way at these things, will find themselves saying, well, hang on a minute, I know that bloke, and he might have a few funny ideas, but he's not a terrorist, and he's allowed to say what he wants to say, isn't he? Or is he? Do you know what I mean?
Also, so, I mean, the police are saying, Basil, that actually they're having loads of their officers cut. I mean, here in Avon and Somerset Force, we've had 600 officers over the last 5 years cut. So how can we have a police state without the police?
Well, there's a difference between a sort of, you know, on the bobby type police and, you know, what one might call the security state, which is the surveillance state and the spies. I don't think any of that's going to be cut. They always seem to have officers when it comes to, you know, putting a battering ram through somebody's door at 5 o'clock in the morning if they need to, you know. But I think what we'll lose is the assisting police, the good old sort of Dixon of Dock Green that was there to help old ladies across the road and sort out sort of minor disputes. And instead we'll have perhaps a physically smaller but sort of heavily armed and, you know, much more aggressive police force. And we've seen this already in the wake of the... It was actually, I think, originally organised because of the Charlie Hebdo attacks. There was a major drill last week in London to coincide with the anniversary of, upcoming anniversary of 7/7 as well. And Special Branch announced the creation, the permanent creation of a sort of paramilitary SAS-style rapid reaction force. So although there may be fewer of them, these are the sort of black-jacketed, machine-gunned, helmeted crowd that are the very antithesis of what Britain is supposed to be about.
British values is interesting, isn't it? Because we're hearing this whole thing about the USR British values, and yet actually what the government seems to be doing is getting rid of those British values as they're saying it. Now, the other possibility here, of course, with the particularly with the European Human Rights Act and the European Union, is that maybe that there is a better court system out there in Brussels or elsewhere, Strasbourg, at The Hague even, for international law. What are your thoughts about that? Because I noticed, horrible, but this week there's just a bit of news about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and that has been being put through some kind of secret European court so that no one's really allowed to know what's happened. It says national governments are doing these things. Private corporations will be able to sue national governments secret courts over policies that cause loss of profits to them, which essentially means that's it, no more democracy.
Yep, you've hit the nail on the head. And this access to democracy, the definition of democracy we use, access to law are all important things. We've seen massive cuts to legal aid recently, which drastically reduces the ability of people without the means to access the courts. We've seen also very important, again, little publicised piece of legislation about changes to the system of judicial review, whereby individuals and organisations can challenge government's decisions in the court and challenge their legality. That's all going to be curtailed. You have to have a direct interest in the case. If you lose, you have to pay costs. Basically, it's made it much more difficult to take the government to court over judicial review. On a different tack, we've also, announcements on the train. You know, if you see anything suspicious, report it, you know. I picked up a story last week. Children could be branded extremists for boycotting McDonald's, according to new anti-terror laws, because that could mean that they, harbour some extremist view, which means they don't want to eat in a McDonald's. You know?
What is your background in sociology? Because, I mean, I actually love sociology as a subject. I think it's one of the most important subjects out there that doesn't often, you know, youngsters are brought up without actually even doing a sort of unit of sociology as part of another course or whatever. But what does it tell you? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of this is really about using fear. It's almost like kind of sheepdogs, the media being the kind of sheepdog there that's saying to people, well, you better not do this, be afraid of this, be afraid of that. And how does that actually affect the wider society?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you'd agree, it's very much a sort of fear-based agenda that people are being fed at the moment. I don't think people realise with sociology the extent to which societal norms and mores and patterns of thinking can be engineered people are inclined to think that everything sort of happens by chance, and there's an assumption that the government, the media, etc., are A, benign, and B, telling the truth. You know, most people actually have the interests of society at large at heart and want to live in a free, open, and tolerant society. It's difficult for people to sometimes realise that there are other people pursuing different agendas.
Well, I would say certainly, you know, some of the senior people that I came across at the BBC were not the kind of people I would want necessarily to be sharing a pint with, or certainly in my living room.
In what way, Tony?
Well, just creepy characters, you know, people who you wouldn't necessarily want to spend a bit of time socially, but then they were, you know, they were senior managers at the time. And I think there's obviously, I mean, this is, if you start to look at the Jimmy Savile scandal, you can see this writ large where you've got, you know, you've got a journalist, Liz McKean, who was working at Newsnight. She manages to get two of Savile's victims on camera, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do with someone to actually get them to relive the experience. A hideous experience in their past, then goes with this, the big story of the year, to their editor, only to be told, oh, we've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up, go away, you know. And then the subsequent cover-up of that, where it then took about 8 months to get the story out through the print media, with all of the national newspapers saying we don't want to know, when the story about what had happened at the BBC was written up, and it only finally being published in the Oldie magazine, written up by Miles Goslett. And then what happens a few months after that, about a year after that, Richard Ingram, who's the editor of the Oldie magazine, the only paper that would publish the story, is given the sack. So actually there's quite a lot behind the scenes. The press seems to be one of the major battlegrounds, never mind the economic warfare, for people's minds.
Yes, and I think that within the press you've got, you know, obviously sort of, you know, often younger, relatively new people who, you know, quite naturally think child abuse is one of the most horrific crimes there is, and that anybody guilty of it deserves to be exposed. And then other factions within the press, as it were, and this also applies within the House of Commons and every other aspect of the establishment, really, who are continuing, although they may sometimes superficially be paying lip service to the fact that they want truth and justice, are actually all the time sweeping the whole thing under the carpet. So there's quite a sort of, you know, a sort of deep-seated battle in British society at the moment. I mean, I saw a headline in the Evening Standard only yesterday saying that a senior policeman has said that the VIP child abusers are going to be named, you know, because it's a year since we heard about Dolphin Square and about the Elm Guest House and all these other various places, and basically the VIP paedophile ring supposedly operating out of Westminster, incredibly enough. And yet, with one or two exceptions, Greville Janner being one of them, you know, most of the names have not yet been named. You know, the Rolf Harris has been hung out to dry, and obviously Savile and various others, but not any of the, you know, very recent or still currently serving senior members of Parliament. And that will shake things up if and when that happens. But don't hold your breath, because it's quite possible that the cover-up will continue.
Well, this whole business of the Human Rights Act came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week, with Harriet Harman putting a question to David Cameron about it.
Harriet Harman. Yeah, I'm
10 years ago, the 7/7 bombers cruelly took 52 precious lives. We remember them, the families' courage and the injured, and we defy the terrorists. Mr. Speaker, last month, the Prime Minister celebrated the Magna Carta, which set out that those who govern must be constrained in their exercise of power to protect those they govern. Our Human Rights Act is the very embodiment of those values. If he accepts that in a democracy there needs to be an effective check on executive power, even though at times it can be uncomfortable for government, will he abandon his plans to water down the Human Rights Act?
Well, first of all, can I very much agree with the Right Honourable Lady with what she said about 7/7, about the 10-year anniversary, about the bravery and the dignity of those families that lost their loved ones. And she, like I, took part in the commemorations yesterday that I thought were fitting and a permanent reminder to the threat we face and the work we must do to face down the evil of these terrorists and their narrative of extremism. The point she makes about the Magna Carta, I would say, demonstrates that there were human rights before the Human Rights Act. And the point I would make is our proposed reform is to have a British Bill of Rights so that more of these judgments are made by British judges in British courts.
Well, I mean, the Human Rights Act is hated by the right wing of the Tory Party because it's seen as a European imposition through the European Union, but of course it's nothing to do with the European Union. It was the Human Rights Act is related to European law prior to the European Union, and it sets a basic standard for everybody, including Vladimir Putin and David Cameron.
Sorry, Basil, you were trying to say something then.
Yeah, well, did you notice as well that Cameron said... combat these terrorists and their narrative of extremism. So you've got to look at the language very closely. He's immediately once again conflated terrorism with a narrative of extremism. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that 7/7 was first and foremost a criminal act. Nobody's ever been prosecuted in a court of law. There's been no trial, you know. So we're moving into an interesting sort of newspeak area where a narrative is framed without due criminal process. And that narrative is then reshaped to widen the net from simply those that committed the acts to basically, by the word extremist, including people with basically opinions that differ from David Cameron's. I mean, who's entitled to say who's an extremist? As far as I'm concerned, David Cameron's an extremist, you know, so maybe he ought to be arrested.
Martin, when you're saying that this needs to be an effective check on executive power, that's what Harriet Harman was saying there. What does she really mean by that?
Well, the point is that the government of the day, the executive, the people in charge, should work within a rule of law. In principle, that's what's supposed to happen. In practice, we all know that the powerful are scofflaws, and they always have been.
And what about people like MI5? Because there doesn't seem to be a very strong oversight of the security services. And actually, they are very much in touch with foreign powers as well, people that might not necessarily be working in Britain's interests.
What we need to do is to get back to proper policing. Because the security services are outside proper policing. So somebody like Haroon Aswat, named by the Metropolitan Police Investigator of 7/7, Brian Paddick, as the mastermind, having definitely been on the phone to all four of the alleged bombers the week before, is put into preventive detention, then sent to Broadmoor, and then extradited to the US, all without being interviewed by an independent police officer. And that, of course, is the real problem, is that the elements within the state which are actually carrying out illegal acts, and in Northern Ireland this week, for example, it came out that the Sampson report 30 years ago named MI5 as being responsible for the death of Michael Teague. But, you know, we've got to have some independent police investigation of all these things rather than just leaving it to security services.
Right, but that's always just that blanket of national security is chucked over that, you know. I mean, the House of Commons doesn't have any effective oversight over the security services at all. You know, they didn't know that GCHQ was conducting all this mass surveillance, you know. I mean, there's the state as defined by the House of Commons and elected officials, and then there's a deep state, you know, of the government that never changes from one... you know, one party to the next.
Okay,
you know,
so this is the permanent.
I mean, there was never any consensus amongst Labour Party supporters who tramped the streets to get Margaret Thatcher out of power that when Tony Blair was elected, they were going to introduce all this authoritarian legislation, but they did. You know, there's a libertarian wing to the Conservative Party represented by David Davis, the so-called, you know, Runnymede Conservatives, but. You know, they don't get anywhere. Instead, it's the authoritarian wing. So, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you've got the Labour Party or the Conservative Party in power. You've got increasing authoritarianism.
We've got big changes going on at the BBC as well, with the corporation being told that they're going to have to be paying now for the elderly people's free TV licences rather than the government, which is a political decision. So a lot of people at the corporation are saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, why are we being forced to pay for that? Now, forget the figures for a minute, the actual specific figures, but I looked at them, and the BBC in 2012 was also told that it had to start paying for for BBC monitoring, which had previously been being paid for, I think, by the Foreign Office, and also from the World Service, which was being paid for by the Foreign Office. And if you look at the effective cut in the BBC's budget that those three changes represent, you're talking around about 20% of the BBC's budget has been taken by the government. Now, that's a weird thing, because actually the BBC could have been in the situation where it wasn't affected by the cuts at all. It was kind of a ring fence because of the licence fee having to be paid by anybody. They would be completely free of any cuts. But what's happened is the government has forced those cuts onto the BBC. And we had Sir Christopher Bland on the TV this week, who is a former chairman of the BBC, actually saying that the BBC is getting worryingly close, Basil, to becoming just another arm of the government.
Well, it certainly seems to be in terms of its editorial content. I mean, we're talking about stoking up the fear recently, a few minutes ago. I mean, the BBC are absolutely past masters of that. I mean, I instead of calling it the BBC News, I call it the BBC Death, because they absolutely love death. There's scarcely any proper investigative journalism left on the BBC. And it increasingly looks and sounds like a mouthpiece for government. I mean, when it comes to chopping their budget, I must admit I'm not the most sympathetic, when you consider that Graham Norton will, over the course of his BBC career, have probably been paid somewhere in the region of £75 million of licence payers' money.
Of course, the thing is, Basil, that cutting the BBC actually plays right into the hands of the Murdoch empire.
Well, I'd like to see a proper open BBC. I mean, why, for example, is there no access, supposedly a publicly funded broadcaster, why is there no access to the airwaves? You know, why can you not actually have fair and balanced reporting about the events we've been talking about?
Well, I remember,
why can't you have a show on the BBC?
Well, I mean, for example,
it's tremendously tight editorial control of what they let go out.
Yeah. I can remember chatting with people who were around when BBC local radio first started, for example, and they said, well, actually, it was just like the community radio you've got at BCFM is, you know, with no hint of security. You could just walk in and chat to people, and if necessary, walk into the studio. In the early days, there was really, you know, kind of no ivory tower mentality at the BBC. Anyway, the new chair of the BBC, well, she's not really new. She was brought in last summer. She's been around for about a year, is Rona Fairhead. She's from the Risk Committee at HSBC. And Martin, the risks been taken by HSBC are pretty cheeky over the last 5-10 years, aren't they?
Well, it's the corporate takeover of all public institutions, isn't it, step by step. Insofar as the BBC was a bulwark of public interest, it's being undermined by corporate malfeasance, step by step.
Because money laundering has been going on at HSBC, and you have to wonder, don't you, whether the conversations around the risk committee that Rona Fairhead was part of, saying, well, what's the risk here? Actually, even if we get caught, we'll only get fined this amount, and so let's just launder the money.
Well, I mean, we know that the banking system is rife with criminality, and yet at the same time, these people are still being given senior. I mean, Lord Green, who was the head of HSBC when they were money laundering for the drug cartels in Mexico, not only not punished, he's brought into the cabinet to advise the Prime Minister.
Anyway, Channel 4 News' Cathy Newman last week spoke to Rona Fairhead, the new chairman of the BBC, who, by the way, her vice chair, she's been involved in appointing, is the chairman of BAE Systems, the biggest arms manufacturer in Europe. These people are now the two characters right at the very top of the BBC tree. And, of course, they have been instrumental in allowing the government to really get away with the things like this getting the corporation to pay for elderly people's licence fees and actually taking massive amounts out of the programme making budgets. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Cathy Newman from Channel 4 News talking to Rona Fairhead, the chairman of the BBC and also director of HSBC.
I would think that the way of charging for the BBC will need to get changed as that move accelerates towards online viewing. Look, I really don't want to get into any discussions. These are discussions that will be for the charter review process. This is about the future. More and more people watch television online, and particularly the young audience. And therefore, that's why the BBC, to serve its audiences, needs to move to that online future. Whether it's the future of the governance or the Prime Minister joking about closing down the BBC or the new culture secretary saying that the licence fee is worse than the poll tax, you must be feeling a little bit under siege from the government, aren't you?
No, I think we haven't started the charter review process. The Secretary of State has been very clear, has publicly committed to making that a full and open public discussion. You know, there are lots of comments around the BBC. Every day there are comments in the media about the BBC. But I think as far as the public is concerned, there is enormous support for the BBC. We did some research.
Enormous support within government? Given that the BBC does have the fight of its life ahead, isn't it time that you devote all of your energies to that rather than the HSBC job as well?
Look, this is not about HSBC. This is about the BBC and this is about the future of the BBC.
But you're juggling both roles, and when you've got such a lot on your plate with the BBC, that must be pretty tricky.
I have been very clear that the BBC is my priority.
How much of a priority is the BBC, though, when you are paid £500,000 a year for the HSBC role?
As I said, my focus is on the BBC. I do spend some time outside the BBC. I think it is right and appropriate that people have other areas of interest, because it keeps that sense of independence. Otherwise, you get into a little bit of groupthink.
You say you're progressively stepping down from HSBC. When will you finally stop that role, then?
Well, I've said that the very latest will be at I've only extended for one more year, which is till next April.
And there's nothing that's going to persuade you to step down earlier than
that? I said I'm progressively stepping down. There are various roles that I do there, and that's what I've committed.
Martin jokingly said in the, as we were listening to that, well, she'll have to step down when she's arrested for money laundering. And actually, there is a case going on at the moment for in the United States against Rona as one of the directors of HSBC for money laundering, which the Daily Mail reported on last summer. Anyway, Basil, back to you for a final comment. How can we do something about this, I suppose I'm saying? How can we fight back? Obviously, you know, we can understand these things, but what about actually trying to turn the tank around?
We've got to try and keep the Human Rights Act, for all its faults. It's the best thing we've got at the moment. It does require recourse to the Hague and all the rest of it, and enshrine certain principles in law, which are very important, and I certainly don't trust the Conservatives to replace it with a Bill of Rights that's anything like as effective. And we've got to speak out about these things. People need to educate themselves, they need to educate each other, they need to lobby their MPs, they need to write articles, come on shows like this, insofar as possible, put pressure on politicians, because they get away with what people acquiesce to. See, most people have got just trying to get on with their own lives and make a living, and austerity is actually a big help for the government in terms of getting through this authoritarian agenda, because people are more concerned just with making ends meet. If people are better off, got a bit more time on their hands, they start wondering what's going on, you know. So we've got to just do everything we can to push back, really. Support whatever groups there are out there. There's the Index on Censorship, there's the Rutherford Institute, there's various groups out there who campaign on these issues. Even, dare I say it, the National Council for Civil Liberties, although they've got their faults, you know. Make people aware of the fact that the drift towards a police state doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's going to be asked for their papers on street corners. You know, you have police states, there's still celebrity culture. They still want everybody distracted. People will still be going to work and going to pub on a Friday night. But the important things are, like, as I said, access to law and freedom of expression. And the one thing we've got to avoid is the ultimate, allowing ourselves to get anywhere near the ultimate police state, which is, of course, where people are afraid to open their mouths and say what they think for fear of it being, you know, noticed in some way. That's when you're looking over your shoulder and whispering behind your hand. That's when they've won. So that's why we all need to stay vocal, Tony.
Okay, that's certainly something we do on here. Basil, maybe you could just let listeners know where they can find you online.
21stcenturywire.com, the Sunday Wire this Sunday from 5 o'clock. Best show on the radio, apart from yours, Tony.
Okay, thanks very much, Basil Valentine. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics
Pleasure.
Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And now I'm joined by Kevin Carhill in the studio. He's been sitting there patiently listening to that. Kevin, I mean, what are your thoughts about the police state initially, before we talk to you about your cases you've been taking against these internet titans?
Okay, well, look at the biggest crisis for policing, Hillsborough. And that's connected to a whole string of other serious misdeeds by the police, and they're never added up. We have to trust the police because there isn't anybody else. But the higher ranks of the police are what need real investigating. Hillsborough was a senior police officer project. It wasn't the bobbies on the beat. The bobbies on the beat wrote down what happened, and then the senior police officers came in and changed it. Then we have this chap, Hogan Howe, who spends more money prosecuting journalists and chasing journalists, through the Anti-Terror REPA Act to find out who's been talking to them. This is the police state, you know, where nobody in the police feels they can have a word with a friendly journalist in the pub. And Hogan Howe has a whole lot of problems, and they should be nailed to his face where journalists are concerned. He's trying to gagged the press through fear. That was raised in your discussion there. So there is a really serious issue. And there are two things happening which the media aren't covering. It's extraordinary. The establishment is in a total crisis. They've got the paedophile thing, and they've got Hillsborough. And some of the key institutions of state are in a state of crisis. They have failed. Not necessarily because they've done wrong, but a lot of them have. But they have simply failed to serve the public. You know, they've spent so much time chasing their own things that the public get forgotten. You know, £40 million prosecuting journalists. And think what the detection rate for burglary is, 17%? That may be a wrong figure, but it's terribly low. And in the meantime, 40 million quid. And if you think of journalists and the police's approach to them, think of Neil Wallace. He was cooked by the police force for which he acted as a PR man.
Now, this week, it's also come out that GCHQ have been spying on the international human rights group, Amnesty International. I mean, is there any kind of... I mean, actually, I think today in The Guardian, Owen Boycott, saying that human rights groups as a whole are now calling for an immediate inquiry into why GCHQ was allowed to spy on Amnesty International. This does seem as if there hasn't actually... Nothing has changed, even since the Edward Snowden revelation. If that kind of thing can go on.
Can I be totally contrarian on this one? GCHQ spying on Amnesty International. The National Security Agency of the United States is spying on about 60% of our population. Which is more important? The national media are not reporting PRISM. You know, they're reporting a row between Amnesty International and GCHQ over something that happened 3 years ago. There's a real danger of this whole investigation into misdeeds by the security system turning into a kind of esoteric dogfight between certain parts of the media, certain parts of the law, and certain parts of the alleged privacy bodies. What's been lost in all of this, and... These are diversions. What's been lost in all of this is the United States is committing criminal offences in the United Kingdom. It's spying on our kids. It's spying on us. And then the national media haven't reported it. I mean, on the 2nd of June, it was stated in Parliament that PRISM, this spying programme, is a criminal offence. Have you heard anything from the government about this? They can't deny it because it is. And it's it
Well, look, Kevin, the positive thing about Amnesty calling for an inquiry and other human rights groups too, National Council for Civil Liberties, Privacy International, etc., is at least giving some sort of focus. Otherwise, I mean, how can you concentrate people's minds on mass surveillance because there's so many millions of people involved?
No, but do you really think that you concentrated by focusing on a very small group of bodies? I think this is a diversion, I'm sure of it, because this came up at this seminar this week. What we need to focus on is why the National Security Agency is gathering all the data. Why? And the national media aren't asking the question.
Okay, tell us about the seminar.
Okay, the seminar was one of the most senior barristers, a QC, in the whole issue of privacy. He's brought the cases against GCHQ and the others in this peculiar court, the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. But if you're an ordinary
who's that? What's the name of the QC?
Oh, the Investigatory... It's a secret court.
No, the QC. Who is the QC?
Oh, Matthew Ryder. And we also had Rachel Logan from Amnesty International. So don't get me wrong, I'm not attacking, but I'm saying there is a terrible feeling of diversion about this away from the actual criminal offence that's being committed every day. This is what the seminar discussed, and it emerged in the seminar that a number of the journalists present felt that we hadn't told the public what's really going on. Now, you can't expect News International to do much about this, can you? It's emerged in the last few weeks that well-known charity, the CIA, when they were short of money, went to Rupert Murdoch. Furthermore, he gave them a couple of $100,000 to help them in their charitable purposes. And that's on the record in the Reagan Presidential Library. It turned up amongst the notes. That good old Rup got in there and bailed out the CIA.
What about your own court cases? Because you've been, you're all action and... Well, you're talk and action, but anyway, you put your money where your mouth is, didn't you? And you actually know a little bit about the legal system. So how do you go about actually taking Microsoft to court or Google, these big companies?
I took Microsoft, Google, and Facebook to court, and I included this spying program, which they are paid to run. And their defense was that the courts of the United Kingdom have no jurisdiction over them. Unfortunately, my case came up in January. In March this year, the appeal court said, sorry, if you operate in this country, you are subject to the jurisdiction of our courts. And that same judgment added something critical. It made a breach of privacy a serious tort, a serious injury. So now these agents of the National Security Agency are facing two pincer movements. They're facing privacy actions, and they're facing the fact that the UK courts have jurisdiction. Ordinary people can now go to court and say, Microsoft, the company that supplies me with stuff for my computer, is stealing all my data, which they are. Now, to go back, at the seminar, the panel was asked, what are you doing about it? And the audience were quite surprised. Well, when I said, "Well, I've sued them," but why haven't the privacy bodies, the theft of the data that these nine companies are doing is actually a criminal offence, and they, in the paper I write for Computer Weekly, we've said this 10 times. They have never sent a single letter threatening libel, because they can't. And the mistake was created by a person in the Home Office. He, this chap, persuaded the intelligence, the Parliamentary Intelligence Committee, and lots of others, that if it was law in the United States, it was okay here. Well, actually, it isn't.
Well, I don't think America, as legal jurisdiction, actually does extend to Britain, last time I looked.
Well, no, and nothing, if I can quote from a letter I wrote to the Chief Justice of the United States, what Congress cannot do and what no law of the United States can do is make legal and lawful acts which are criminal and unlawful in the United Kingdom. And the Nine Prism Company, I hate using this word because it, you know, ordinary people, prism, what's prism? What these nine companies have done is a continuous criminal offence since 2007. And the interesting thing is Cameron knows, and he has been unable to persuade Obama to pull off. Obama's, the program is running, and all this information on ordinary British people.
Just remind us who those companies are, who they are.
Okay, they are Microsoft, Google, Facebook, AOL, Yahoo, YouTube, Skype.
And what you're saying is, you mentioned something quite interesting a little while. You're saying that these companies are being paid to run this prison program.
Oh, yeah. The National Security Agency does not exist in British law. It's a foreign intelligence agency, and it's paying these nine companies hundreds of millions of dollars to spy in the United Kingdom. It is crazy. But this is the kind of slow-motion catastrophe that's happening inside the establishment and isn't being reported.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about this? Because we're in a situation, as Kevin's describing there, as a very slow slide towards a surveillance state. That is where actually the authorities, in this case GCHQ, the National Security Agency, think that they have rights to all of your data, including things like bank passwords, all this kind of stuff.
Everything.
Well, I mean, it's not really a slow slide, is it? It's a coup d'etat in a fairly short space of time. And I think if you look at the US Constitution, I think they've got it in the original Constitution. They said it's forbidden to interfere with private communications without a warrant from a judge. And it's in the Constitution.
But here's the thing. In the United States, the National Security Agency can't do this. Mm-hmm. What it's doing here. If the National Security Agency did in the United States what it's doing here through these nine companies, they would be out. They really would be done.
Now, I can remember from the Yakuza agreement, which was quite, this is going back about 20 years or so, is that they had a system, didn't they, where the US agencies, like the NSA, would be spying on the Brits and then handing that information over to the people like MI5 and MI6 and security services and the government here, and the other way around in the United States. So GCHQ would be spying on the US population and handing that information on to the American government.
Yeah, our spooks never had the reach of these nine companies. These nine companies cover about 80% of our population, and it is extremely serious. The other thing that emerged in the seminar is none of the media, and I include myself in it, have explained to John Smith, the dustman in Birmingham, why does your data matter to these people? And the answer is they create profiles so they can manipulate you. That's all in the public domain.
Okay, so 5 to 7 now. So we really ought to cover some of the other stories this week. Martin, we've had it's a bit of a standoff, isn't there, over this Iran nuclear deal, with the Iranians absolutely sticking to their guns and saying we're not going to sign a deal unless part of that deal is lifting sanctions straight away.
Well, it's obviously got coming under attack from the right wing in Israel and in the United States, and Obama probably wants it to go through as part of his legacy. But it's not at all clear that it's going to go through because there's all sorts of other factors complicating it, the war in Syria, relations with Russia, etc.
Kevin, what are your thoughts about the police files on child sex abuse at Gordonstone School in Scotland going missing in the Highlands, where the male members of the British royal family were educated, and the chap who was supposed to have, the schoolmaster there, done the abusing, dies in a car crash in Africa?
Yeah, if it's really sensitive and affects the royals, and I don't know how the inquiry is going to deal with this, you find nothing surfaces. Everything's been burnt, shredded, disappeared.
Yes, but you see, then that's perverting the course of justice, which is a very serious offence itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about places like Gordonstone? It's all sort of out of the way. It kind of sounds like a bit of a spooky place. And this is really for the elite, the aristocracy of British society.
Well, certainly the atmosphere in Gordonstone was severe. And I would have said it was neo-fascist. you know, discipline, and there was this horrible ring of the Hitler Youth about, you know, running around in the cold showers of Scotland, and it was really nasty. But I think where it affects the royals, nothing will be found.
The West is losing the Twitter battle with fanatics, says General Sir Richard Barron, says the armed forces must take up the fight on social media. He's actually saying, Martin, that they should start lying on social media in order to win the war against the extremists.
Well, I mean, it's not really news to us that these people lie on social media, but I think it's very indicative of the way things are going. They're talking about narrative in relation to terrorism rather than factual matters. How was a bomb made? Who carried it? Who gave the orders? We're talking all the time in broad brush terms of people having crazy ideas that have got to be suppressed. This is actually anti-police, if you like, anti-investigation. It's a way of smoothing over the contradictions in official stories.
Yeah, if you hire a soldier, what you should do is give him a gun and put him in a trench. You shouldn't allow him loose in social media or anything else. This general is talking through his hat. This is the wrong way to go about dealing with terrorism.
There's another story on Media Lens, critical media website, saying hacks and spooks, close encounters of a strange kind. And this is from a conference earlier on this year. They're looking at a whole load of statistics to do with the number of spooks, and something which has supposedly been abolished, called the Information Research Department, saying basically 50% of foreign correspondents from our London press, TV, radio, and etc. are actually being paid, never mind just being friendly with, but actually getting money from the MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Services.
Yeah. You see, if you or I impersonated a spook, we'd be in serious trouble. But the spooks are allowed to suborn and impersonate us and put us at risk, at no risk to themselves. There should be, the real answer is put a law that any spook who interferes with or pretends to be a journalist gets 5 years.
How do you tell the difference between a journalist and a journalist spook then?
You develop suspicions over the years.
I mean, what's your experience of this? Do you think there really is so many people involved?
I do.
What evidence do you have for that?
Well, again, it's going to be esoteric, but very briefly, I once needed some documents, and I picked three Fleet Street senior journalists and gave them a story. And would you believe the documents I needed turned up about 4 weeks later? So I didn't know which one it was. That's the trouble.
Okay. Time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Arabian Nights. Possibly our sister show Dialects here on Tuesdays at noon, where you can hear from an economic hitman. And also part two of the Princess Diana in her own worlds. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Anthony Negus and Christine Townsend. Also thanks to Basil Valentine and Kevin Carhill and Martin Summers. You can follow us on Twitter, but we're back in 2 weeks. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and we're online at thisweek.org.uk. See you in 2 weeks' time.
Live from the Sky News Centre.